not only the numerical majority churches, but also those whose tradition was formed, especially in the 16th century origins, by the fact that the Reformation was official, was done by the government. That means the Lutheran, the Reformed, or Calvinist, or Presbyterian, and the Anglican or Episcopalian traditions, and others that spun off from them with the passage of time and accepted the same heritage, like the Congregationalists of New England for a while. What is the alternative to that? Some scholars call it radical reformation, some call it free church. It doesn't have a precise name because it isn't a precise thing. Since it isn't organized centrally or by government, it can't be nearly as describable and as unified in its history. And therefore, we've just taken soundings representing this kind of critique. The title for today includes another phrase that is not widely familiar, the rule of Christ as an alternative to individualism. So first I'll have to show you where that phrase comes from, the rule of Christ. And to do this, I read from pages 61 and following of volume 53 of Luther's works. In 1526, Martin Luther circulated what he called the German Mass, that is the basic liturgy, translated from Latin into German for the use of parish churches, for everybody, and with only such theological changes from the old Roman Catholic Mass as were theologically imperative, that is a conservative adaptation. He was by no means the first person to prepare a German language liturgy. Several had been done before him which had made more changes than he wanted to make. In the preface to this in the publication, he says he wants to have in the church as it ought to be three kinds of divine service or mass. The first is the one in Latin. He had already put out a Protestant Latin mass form. It is not now my intention to abrogate or change this service. It shall not be affected in the form which we have followed. We shall continue to use it when or where we are pleased and prompted to do so, for in no wise would I want to discontinue the service in the Latin language. Now, why do you think he didn't want to discontinue the Latin language? Because he was interested in young people, he says, by which he meant, of course, students, for whom then the Latin language was the Latin language of all education. Even people who spoke German in the home did all of their intellectual life in Latin, and that made a worldwide intellectual community. He assumed that is in the nature of things, so he wanted those people to continue to be able to do their worshiping in their intellectual language of Latin. And he liked to keep that. In fact, this is utopianism, if I could bring it to pass, and if Greek and Hebrew were as familiar to us as the Latin, and had as many fine melodies and songs, we would hold Mass, sing, and read on successive Sundays in all four languages, German, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And he also thought that the people would then be more able to be foreign missionaries. He never finished sending out foreign missionaries, but he thought of it once. The second form of worship is this document which he is now writing the preface to. This is the German Mass, and this is for everybody. For the sake of the unlearned lay folk, for all the people, among whom are many who do not believe and are not yet Christians. Everybody was baptized. Everybody came to church. They had to, or the cops went after it. But they weren't all, in Luther's own mind, believers. Most of them stand around and gape, hoping to see something new, just as if we were holding a service among the Turks or the heathen in a public square or out in a field. That is not yet a well-ordered and organized congregation in which Christians should be ruled according to the gospel. On the contrary, the gospel must be publicly preached to some people to move them to believe and become Christians. Those are the ones for whom the new German liturgy, parish liturgy, is being prepared. Those people who aren't really believers yet. The third kind of service, so he wants to have three church orders running parallel. The third kind of service should be a truly evangelical order and should not be held in a public place for all sorts of people. But those who want to be Christians in earnest and who profess the gospel with hand and mouth That means they commit themselves, they make a confession with their mouth, and they actually will shake hands. That was going to be the liturgy of making a commitment. Should sign their names, there'll be a written document, and meet alone in a house somewhere to pray, to read, to baptize, to receive the sacrament, and to do other Christian works. Two centuries later, the Pietist movement picked this text up and said that means we should have our Pietist Bible study cells and prayer cells. This is different because these people are going to baptize and celebrate the Eucharist in these house churches. According to this order, those who do not lead Christian lives could be known, reproved, corrected, cast out, or excommunicated according to the rule of Christ. There you got it. Matthew 18. Here one could also solicit benevolent gifts to be willingly given and distributed to the poor, according to St. Paul's example, 2 Corinthians 9. Here would be no need of much and elaborate singing. Here one could set up a brief and neat order for baptism and the sacrament and center everything on the word, prayer, and love. Here one would need a good short catechism on the Creed, the Ten Commandments, and Our Father. In short, if one had the kind of people and persons who wanted to be Christians in earnest, the rules and regulations would soon be ready. But as yet, I neither can nor desire to begin such a congregation or assembly or to make rules for it, for I have not yet the people or persons for it, nor do I see many who want it. But if I should be requested to do it, and could not refuse with a good conscience, I should gladly do my part and help as best I can. In the meanwhile, the two above-mentioned orders of service must suffice. So we'll have to get along with the elite church in Latin and the mass church of people who are mostly not Christian, going through the liturgy, and maybe sometime the Lord will raise up some of these people who want to be Christians in earnest, and then we can have the third form, which would be a free church, and which Luther never found the people for, but several other radical groups did, and got persecuted for it. But the mark of this free church in Luther's vision was going to be, among other things, voluntary commitment. They would sign their names. And the rule of Christ, Matthew 18. Now, what does Matthew 18 say? Everybody have it memorized? This phrase, rule of Christ, occurs also elsewhere in the 16th century Reformation among people who cannot have read it here by Luther because they were using it before this text. And it's a puzzle for the historians. I haven't found any historians of that period, the early 1520s, who can show what the common source is from which both Luther and these other people got the phrase, or the usage of this phrase, rule of Christ, to refer to these three verses. Matthew 18:15. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every word may be confirmed by the absence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church, meaning the local community. If he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. That passage is what somebody, from whom both Luther and other people took this phrase, called the rule of Christ. Rule not in the sense of reign, but guideline. This is the way Jesus says do it. Now, what does this text say? Its total context is one not of condemnation or judgment or punishment, but of forgiveness. This is how to go about forgiving. All of the rest of chapter 18 of Matthew is about forgiveness. There are teachings about how many times to forgive, and Jesus says not seven times is enough, but 70 times seven. There are parables about why to forgive and what if you don't forgive and people who didn't forgive. The whole chapter is teaching forgiveness. So this passage is also about how to forgive. The procedure is personal and private. If your brother has offended, you go to him. And as there is no officer in the church for this, it's not a clerical function. In fact, it's private, the two of you alone. And the normal thing that should happen would be that from this face-to-face encounter there will come reconciliation. You have won your brother, and the story is over. In case any people are looking for such a textual thing, this is the biblical proof text for the prohibition of gossip. The old translations say, if your brother sins against you. Contemporary translations are divided on that question because the two words translated against you, just three little letters in Greek, are not in the best manuscripts. And that's not an unimportant, debatable point. There's a parallel in Luke 17, verse 3, where the against you obviously isn't present. The reason that matters is that if I think I should go to the person who has offended me because I am offended, if your brother sins against you, go to him, then I tend to think that the reason to go to him is that I'm offended. That is, that I have to get off steam, or that I have a problem. If, on the other hand, that is not there as a qualifying phrase, then the reason to go to the other person is the other person needs to be restored. The other person needs to be made aware of their offending, of their not being in a state of obedience and fellowship, and be restored to that state through this intervention. So forgiveness needs to happen for the sake of the offender, and only secondarily for the sake of the one offended. And if you leave in those little five little letters there, then you tend to think that forgiveness is for the sake of the one offended. The way that undercuts the valid process is that if it's the case that the reason I need to go to the other person to be the mediator of forgiveness for them is that I'm mad, then if I'm a more spiritual person, or if I'm mature, or if I'm big enough, I can say, well, I've forgotten that, I've absorbed it, I'm bigger than she is, I won't let that person get me off the track of my mental equilibrium. And so I can fail to forgive that person, fail to mediate forgiveness to that person, because I think it's my problem I'm being authorized to deal with by this passage. So this is instruction given by Jesus to his disciples about how to deal with conflict in the community. Not by absorbing it, not by ducking it, not by transposing it into a political hassle or a doctrinal hassle, not by referring it to the clergy, but by direct confrontation with the intention of reconciliation. There's one more dimension of the language that needs explanation. The verbs Jesus uses for this process are binding and loosing. Did you ever think about what that might mean? It's not ordinary language. It is technical language used by the rabbis. A devoted and sincere Jew facing a question concerning which he didn't know what was right, because it was complicated or a borderline question or he wasn't well informed, who wanted to do the right, would bring his question to the rabbi, and the rabbi would look through his mental file drawer of cases and stories and memories and biblical interpretations, and would come with a pronouncement saying you are bound or you are loosed. If you're bound, there is an obligation in the law. Our word obligation means binding. It's just the Latin word for bindingness. And if the answer is you're free, you're not obligated, then it's loosed. That's the rabbinic language for helping people make serious moral choices. So Jesus is bringing into some kind of connection two different questions, different in our mind. One is forgiving and not forgiving, and the other is dealing with moral issues. But isn't forgiving and not forgiving the way we do deal with moral issues? That is, if something's really important, it will show in the fact that we hold it against somebody that they don't do what we think is right. And if we have come to see that our standards were wrong, the way to change our standards is to forgive somebody that we thought had offended, now that we see that they didn't really do anything wrong because our standards are the ones that are wrong. So there is a substantial interlock between these two different functions of making moral decisions, which is the technical meaning that Jesus must have been wanting to refer to when he used the specific phrase bind and loose, or when Matthew reported it this way. And the other is the process of restoring personal community through forgiveness. Those two things overlap in ways that are worth looking at more than we can take time to do it now. And the last striking thing about this paragraph is that Jesus says, you do this in God's name. If you forgive somebody, they're forgiven. And if you don't, they aren't. We have this also somewhere else. Anybody remember from memory the parallel? This isn't the only place this is said. This is in the ministry of Jesus, somewhat before the Passion yet. He's still in Galilee. Where else do we have something very parallel? Yeah, where in the story? Where else in the story was that? It's in the Easter story according to John's Gospel. John chapter 20.
23.
Yeah. That the word bind and loose is not used. The word forgive and retain is used. And there it's even more striking. If we can define what it was about Jesus that offended certain people in the Jewish establishment, it was that he claimed that the Father had sent him in a specific way. But in that Easter appearance, Jesus says, as the Father sent me, I send you. And he's charging his disciples with the scandal of what he'd been doing. And then he made it even worse, because if within what Jesus was doing that offended people there was any crux of what was most offensive, it was that he told people their sins were forgiven. And now he tells his disciples to do that, and to do it in God's name. If you forgive somebody, God has forgiven them. Now you can understand why that hasn't got much play in Protestant circles, because it sounds like the Catholics. So wherever anti-Catholic reflexes are strong, we're embarrassed by that kind of a mandate. Or we try to transpose it into saying that the way you forgive people's sins is just to preach, and the way you don't forgive people's sins is also just to preach, and then they make their own decision. And God gratifies that. That isn't what the text says. The text talks about a process in which if there is reconciliation, then we are in good fellowship, and these people are in fellowship not only with the brothers and sisters, but with the Father. And if that process of reconciliation fails, then the people who have thereby counted themselves out are out. That's taking history very seriously. I mean, it's a very sobering and frightening mandate to be given to us, and so it's not surprising that we've been afraid of it. Elsewhere in the New Testament, we can find reinforcement for the thing that is capsuled in this passage. Obviously, the centrality of forgiveness is in many other places. In two of the Pauline writings, it is said directly, forgive others as you were forgiven, both in Ephesians and Colossians. In Matthew 6, that is within the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus talks about how not to pray and fast and give alms, and his model for how to pray, the so-called Lord's Prayer, has in it only one petition, which is conditional. All the others are simply either praise or petition. Give us our bread, lead us not into temptation. But one of the petitions is conditional. Forgive us as we forgive, or as we have forgiven. And it's the only one which is commented on after Jesus gave the prayer. Immediately after that, he comments, and if you don't forgive, you won't be forgiven. So the centrality of forgiving process in the life of the community is very clear in the New Testament. We also see the process at work a few times in the New Testament writings. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul is responding to a question sent to him from the church in Corinth about whether it's all right that one of their members has taken another of their members to court about some business controversy. And Paul says several things. First, you shouldn't place that much trust in the pagan courts, because after all, we don't believe that the pagan courts are where God is working. But we're going to judge them instead of them judging us. Thirdly, he says, after all, if you really understood what it means to be a Christian, you'd just let yourself be taken advantage of and wouldn't bother with the whole process of defending yourself. But in between those two statements, there's another one that says, don't you have anybody in your midst that can do what Jesus talked about? Isn't there anybody wise that can mediate? Well, the mediator would be precisely the second stage in what Jesus said. You went to him and it didn't work, then you call in somebody from the church instead of going to the courts. So Paul was assuming that there ought to be in the church in Corinth a kind of conflict resolution agency. That was one of the functions that some wise person in the community ought to exercise, which would carry out the second phase of this reconciliation process of the rule of Christ. We also have in Galatians 6 a passage which we sometimes skew a little in our understanding, because we don't see how close it comes to this same topic. If a person is undertaken in a trespass, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Look to yourself, lest you be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. Now, maybe that's where they got the phrase rule of Christ, because Paul is talking about the same thing. Bear one another's burdens may sometimes mean think about the poor, but not in this passage. In this passage, bear one another's burdens means discipline each other, exhort each other when they need it, forgive each other when they need it. Take on yourself the burden and the trauma and the cost of restoring a person by confrontation with a view to forgiveness. And the last, very last verses of James' epistle say the same kind of thing. Now, I have to come back to how this connects to contemporary free church critique. This rule of Christ was a phrase used by the various reformers, we saw that. For the radical reformers of the 16th century, the reason for not baptizing infants, in the very earliest document we have, which dates from September 1524, was not that an infant cannot have a born-again experience, as the Baptists would say it, and not that an infant cannot receive the proclamation of grace, as Karl Barth would say it, but it was that an infant cannot commit himself to live under the rule of Christ. And if you don't have that commitment on the part of your members, you can't have a church. It wasn't only the Anabaptists who thought this. Martin Bucer, the predecessor of Calvin at Strasbourg, Calvin's theological father, and later a kind of a mediator between the Reformed and the Lutheran traditions at Strasbourg, he believed for all his life that the reform of the church won't be finished. We have established a process whereby we know which of the people in the mass church, and he wanted a mass church, but which of the people within that larger mass church commit themselves to practice the rule of Christ with each other. And those would be the Christian communities within the mass church. He never got that and was finally exiled from Strasbourg for reasons of overarching empire politics. But he continued to demand it as indispensable. And is to commit yourself to a process of admonition, exhortation, encouragement, reconciliation is the definition of a non-individualistic and of a non-mass church. The best theologian of the radical Reformation of the 16th century developed at great length the claim, the reason we can't have a Reformation, the reason we have been now for 5 or 10 years preaching the Bible and things don't shape up, is that the people we're preaching at have never committed themselves to obey the Bible. No wonder we can't have a Reformation. The people we're preaching at are just what they were before. They had been christened by the medieval machine, and the fact that we now have charge of the pulpits and we're preaching Protestant doctrine instead of Catholic doctrine makes no real difference, because they hadn't committed themselves to listen to either. It was the kind of thing that Luther was saying. They're just watching what's going on, like as if they were Turks, or if you were doing a show in the field. So the renewal of the church was not just a renewal of getting your doctrine straight about the meaning of sacraments or even the meaning of salvation, but restructuring a community that would be committed. And the test of commitment that is functional, probably the most profound, is do you commit yourself to listen to each other and to go to each other when something important separates you, that is important in the light of faith? So that's the process for which the rule of Christ, the phrase rule of Christ, became a label. It never happened in the big churches. It has happened often in renewal movements, in all kinds of renewal movements. But one of the things that happens is that people discover a new freedom, or a new obligation either, or a new burden, to go to each other and to set right tensions and squabbles and differences of opinion and angers that had not been processed in forgiveness. This is the only view of the church that makes that the definition of the church. The church is where it happens, that we live up to a commitment to forgive each other. Not something that is done just off the pulpit or through a liturgy, or that is preached in the preaching in such a way that every person can apply to themselves and forgive themselves. Now, to be forgiven means that somebody talks to me and I listen. And my wanting to be forgiven is a social event. That's stated very schematically. I could fill it out from more documents, but I think the schematic statement is enough for the present. Obviously, since then, there have been all kinds of moves in church renewal, pietist movement, revivalism, and now much more recently, trends in psychology and group process, where elements of this same kind of insight have come up, sometimes from secular sources, sometimes from transplanted Christian sources, where the wrongness of not going to somebody when you have something against them can be explained in psychological terms, or the wrongness of transferring a conflict to a third party or an authority or the government or the deacon is seen. But some of that is pretty faddish, and some of it is clearly explained as to why it should be proper in the context of the reformers listening to Jesus in Matthew 18. There was a clear and deep theological basis for the whole thing. We are the bearers of a message of forgiveness. If that message of forgiveness is going to be real on any other level, it must first be real among those of us who have committed ourselves to live it together. So I think it is still the case in numerous of the churches from the Radical Reformation that at the point of baptism, part of the questioning, part of the litany is, do you promise, if you have something against a brother or sister, to go to them in a spirit of meekness? And if someone comes to you, do you promise to receive them in a spirit of meekness? That's part of the pledge of baptism. When I talked about the alternative to individualism, I didn't mean that there aren't many other places that individualism also would have to be dealt with. And I didn't even mean that if we'd have this process, we wouldn't have any individualism. But it certainly is one point at which the definition of what it means to be Christian together would be radically deeper and warmer. If we could finally find the people that want to be Christians in earnest, that Luther wanted to do this with. So much for introduction. We have more time than usual to knock it around.
Who was the theologian you were referring to?
Balthasar Hubmaier.
Can you spell that?
You can spell the first name almost anyway. that is, there were various, there were various spellings of both names. But I guess if you'd look him up in the Yale Library, it would be Hubmaier.
Maier.
He was burnt at the stake in Vienna in March of 1528.
My question is, in this process, who judges? Mm-hmm.
Well, the beauty of it is that you don't need to know. See, if you don't tell third parties, and you just go to your brother or sister and say, I think you did wrong, and your intention is forgiveness, you'll figure out whether your judgment was right or not. Maybe your standards were wrong. But since you're going to the person in a spirit of meekness, you'll find that out. Much better than if you stay home and said, I don't want to judge, but I still think it was wrong. So it's a much more open process. In fact, the beauty of the process is that you don't need to know really who's wrong, because you set it right in any case. In fact, there is the alternative is in Matthew 5. Lord Jesus really says it the other way around too. If you are going to present your offering, your sacrifice at the altar, and you become aware, or you remember, somebody has something against you, clear that up first. There it's the offender that is responsible to do it. Matthew 18, it's the offended one that's responsible to do it. So nobody's not responsible. And the thing to do in both cases is to set it right forgivingly between the two of you. So you don't really have to answer the question, how do I know my standards are right? You'll talk about that together. And therefore modesty about whether my standards are right is no reason for not doing it.
How does this tie into confession of sins between believers that don't have anything to do with against one of the parties,
yeah.
but just things in general, which is again part of the Christian community that sought after.
Well, as I said when I referred to the little against you that's in the text, but not in all the best manuscripts. It isn't only at the point of my being offended that this ought to happen. But if I know you committed a victimless sin, whatever that would be, and that the offended person isn't around, or the offended person is dead, I'm still responsible. So that it isn't only because it's against me. And I think there would be room, it doesn't happen to be in this text, but there would certainly be room to build into this the affirmation, which was still there in Luther, that confession has a place. Don't put it in the mechanism of absolution where the Roman system had it, but there should be auricular confession. Luther still wanted that, and some Lutheran churches have had their ups and downs in keeping that. There, however, it's kind of the responsibility of the person who knows his or her guilt to define it and to want to be freed from it through a process of confessing. And here it's just shared by more people, because anybody who knows about it is also in on the restoration. So it would be complementary to that idea.
I thought that the person who is the who has been offended is also responsible. Kind of blows my mind a little bit, because I think in our society as well as in the church, you never hear about someone doing that. If you're offended, well, you hear about it. Yes, I shouldn't say never. I have.
But it's bad manners if it happens. So.
Yeah, but you just don't do that. I mean, it's better than you stay hurt until the guy who. Is supposed to right it, the guy who made the wrong is supposed to right his own wrong. And I was just thinking, my gosh, that, in our society, or even just our Christian society, what a change that would make, totally, if we actually could absorb that concept that we, if we are have been offended, that it's, we have a responsibility to clear this up.
Well, there are all kinds of explanations.
Relationship that would begin.
Oh, it could be fantastic. It could be gospel. But it is worth kind of do the autopsy or the interpretation of why it is that it doesn't happen. One is, of course, we were told as we grew up that if you're a big boy, you won't cry. And that the mature thing to do is to absorb hurts and not need to get it said, or at least unless it's very dramatic. And if it's very dramatic, then it's your inward need. It's not their need. So here the concern is that the other party is out of grace, and it's a service to the other party to be the agent of forgiveness. And that's just much more good news than the ways we've bottled up the sense of offense, or thought that if we're really a man or if we're really a mature person, then we won't show that we're hurt, or we won't hurt, or we'll absorb the hurt, or we're such a big person that we can absorb a lot of hurt. And in all of these ways, we build a fence against the real vulnerability of sharing the fact that I think you've done me wrong, and processing that conviction between the two of us. Oh.
You used the word absolution a short time ago. Would you care to define it or draw a distinction between absolution and forgiveness?
I'm not sure I know enough of the history of the language for a definition I would try to be adequate. Except that, of course, what has been thought bad about the high church practices was the kind of mechanical and wooden connection between a ceremony or a liturgical word, or the fact the priest has been consecrated in order to be able to do this thing, and the being freed. But I suspect that just linguistically, to be absolved and to be forgiven are not that different. It's just what we've made of them in the different institutional settings.
Well, if we are absolved, then there should be no need afterward to make restitution, which would also indicate that we were not guilty in the first place, otherwise we could be absolved.
No, I don't think it's the same as acquitted. I think absolution applies to a real debt. I'm not quite sure of my memories of the basic roots, but I kind of think that the Greek aphiemi and the Latin, from which we get absolution, are almost linguistic equivalents. They just both mean letting loose. And forgiving would be our anglicization of the German roots that also kind of mean just let go away, give away. So that I think it occurs, it applies to a real offense. So that the question of restitution would apply as an outworking of my agreeing that I have committed an offense. I want to help as I can to make it right. But it would probably be wrong also there to connect it, as the medieval legalism did, with a certain amount of performance, especially with performance that isn't making it right, but just penance. So many pilgrimages or so many prayers. That kind of penance I don't see any point of. But restoration, when you can do it, I would think is often fitting if one is really repentant. Not as a condition of the forgiveness, but as an outworking of the joy of receiving forgiveness.
John, I don't, it may sound like I'm going to oversimplify the premise or the scripture. I don't mean to do that, but I think there is a practical matter that the size of the group is not an insignificant part of whether or not the rule of Christ will be lived out or can be lived out. I don't think it's accidental that Luther said that that group would meet in a home. I don't think it was a clerical comment when Gordon Cosby said you cannot be pastor to more than about 60 people. I also think he meant pastoring one another. There is a certain size. I was part of a community in Washington, D.C., and we made a basic decision that we would not get larger than able to do decision making by consensus, and there's a certain size at which that's kind of awkward, but when you know one another quite well, that's a very not only biblical but efficient way of making decisions, and it's a kind of trusting of one another and not a majority vote. But we had the kind of thing that you're talking about within that group, partly because we all knew one another. I think if a free church or a Lutheran church gets to a certain size, that will be a very difficult thing to do. I'm not saying that automatically you'll have it if you determine to be small, but I think it's a matter that we haven't really faced in what it means to live in a Christian community. I don't know that that's in the form of a question. Sometimes questions are in really short speeches. So.
No, that certainly has to be a part of the picture. I don't know whether it would be the same in all societies, that 30 is the right amount or 60,
yeah.
Gordon's figure or more. I think it depends on how mobile the people are,
yeah.
And many other factors that have to do with the depth of their acceptance of one another. Let me dramatize the difference, why I don't like to set a figure, but first I would agree with the statement that size is a factor. This is talking about a social process, and any social process has to deal with the laws of sociology. You can't trust people that you don't know, that you haven't practiced trusting, that you haven't seen functioning in a relationship that defines why you should trust them. So there has to be a size limit, and if you're going to do this in a large parish, you'd have to break the parish up into Sunday school classes or neighborhood study groups or something that would create the sense of trust that would be able to do this. But how large that group should be, I think we should be a little flexible. And my way of illustrating this is to point out the great difference in mobility and flexibility and articulateness. If you have a stable rural community where everybody goes to the same school and shops at the same place, and all the breadwinners are either farmers or people who service farmers with the local banking and filling station and general store, etc., so that you genuinely have a village in the old sense. And they don't have television yet because it's in 1910. Those people know each other so well that there can be 250 of them. And still, in a meeting, when three have spoken, everything has been said. Because there's so little source of input for new ideas, there's so much common backlog of what they do know, that you can have a perfectly open meeting and nobody is trampled on and squelched and three people have spoken and everybody thinks what has been said speaks for me. In campus ministries, if you have a group of 10 people, you haven't had everything spoken until 20 have said their because these people are in the business of change. They are dealing with the mass media input. They are dealing with the personal growth agenda in a way that doesn't happen in that ancient village in the same model. So how much it takes to be able to do this has to be asked in every social context. And there's certainly something wrong with church growth visions that don't include asking, where is this going to happen? Because it won't happen over the pulpit. It has to happen in people with groups that can meet in a house.
Can that, I guess in the, it's nice to think of new churches and congregations forming where the size is small, but in you of necessity have to deal with churches that are already there, and can that effectively happen in a larger congregation by breaking it up into caring groups or sharing groups or whatever you want to call them and still maintain the larger community of worship?
I mean, that would be the challenge we'd have to work at. There are different ways you can think of. You might just say certain individuals would do it themselves and not consider it as counter to their parish loyalty. Or you might say that the parish decision-making group will start being this for themselves, and if it works, then they'll start spinning off. Or if everybody really believed in it, I mean, if Luther really believed in it, he could have just divided Wittenberg into 24 neighborhoods and told them how to do it, and then they'd find out if they were Christians or not. So there'd be different ways, but I think you're right, it would take a special kind of initiative to figure out how to do it. Now the later pietists actually quoted this text, as I said, they misquoted it, because in Strasbourg and then elsewhere in Germany in the 18th century, they started prayer circles, or caring circles, Bible study circles, which intentionally didn't want to rock the boat at all on the parish level. So they didn't have sacraments. But they'd pray and study the Bible and deepen one another's commitment and encourage one another in the faith. And they quoted this. They said, it must be all right to do this because Luther said he wanted to have this as soon as he had any people that wanted to be seriously Christian. And that's us. It's been tried before to create fellowship circles within the larger parishes. In fact, numerous contemporary renewal movements are doing this. Faith at Work and Yoke Fellows, and there are various renewal structures that use this kind of concern. My question would just be, do we have a right to leave anybody out of it that's really a member of the church? And it tends to be a kind of an elite thing for the people who have either more time or more piety on their hands than the rest. And then we're falling short of what it ought to be for everybody.
You mentioned before that when it's one-to-one, the person who's being called upon is not assumed to be the one under judgment. But when you take it the next step and you have a couple coming to smoke them out, isn't that a little more of a power play? Harder to retain the grace of it?
I wouldn't think that it's if the two of us are at loggerheads about who's wrong. But we're committed, we're both of us committed to both to being disciples of Jesus and to forgiveness. And then when we call in the best two or three additional people we can get, their motivation is going to be reconciling.
Yeah.
And ours is.
Of the one person really not wanting the whole process, so we bring a couple more.
Well, if the one person really doesn't want the process, then the couple more, their challenge is to get him to see he promised this and he must want it. And why can't we get through to you? But Paul says, you do it in a spirit of meekness, knowing you're likewise tempted. We have to find non-self-righteous ways to ask why it is that you don't want to share this thing with us.
That's a key point. If in this particular Matthew passage, meekness isn't stated. And
but the whole chapter is on forgiveness.
But I've been involved where we were both, where two people were committed to this principle, but it was at a loggerheads kind of commitment rather than a meekness, and it really just was very difficult.
But even there, If both are committed to it, that's different. We're having two different models here. One is when the other person doesn't want to listen. And then the two or three who come along, they're kind of all helping to try to establish a conversation. If two are committed to it, but they're loggerheads, then their sense of needing the others to help, I think, is an advantage. But of course, you can fight wars with this kind of language, too. But it isn't a gimmick that always works. It's a guideline that works if we believe in it.
When Luther set this up as a model of the rule of Christ, as one kind of service, did he still retain a pronouncement of forgiveness within the service? It seems to me that that if you're going to have some kind of statement of forgiveness by the clergy, then that what should have been taking place in the course of the week between Christian friends or Christian people, then that pronouncement takes on a whole different. That's a kind of a reminder to you that you've been living within the context of forgiveness, and it isn't that kind of superficial corporate confession of sins and general pronouncement of forgiveness.
Well, I don't think Luther had to answer that question since the third one never went. It's a problem. He maybe felt more comfortable not having to answer it because there was a contradiction. He was really running two different churches. I mean, he had two different visions of what the church must be. In fact, they were both going to baptize. And they were both going to have Eucharist. But, of course, he went on having the Eucharist for everybody, in which the absolution of everybody is a major turning point in the liturgy, and not interpreted as deeply as the meaning you're giving it. Of course, you're giving that deeper meaning from further centuries of pastoral concern, and from less and less believing like Luther that this whole baptized mess is mostly not Christians.
I'm thinking of the one passage in Matthew 18 where it says, let him be to you as a Gentile or a tax collector. The church has historically used that as an excuse for excommunication, whereas Jesus used the Gentile and the tax collector as the target for his special concern and evangelism. It's quite a contrast.
Yeah, well, thanks for adding that. Even Luther's language kind of piles up the negative verbs. Those who do not lead Christian lives could be known, reproved, corrected, cast out, or excommunicated. That's just one verb with a lot of synonyms, but it sounds a little blunter than that. But it means simply telling this person, you want out, don't you, for now. Well, we still want you in, but the way to get in is the way the publicans and the Gentiles get in, by repentance. And we're especially concerned for your repentance.
Yeah, it means that forever afterwards, that person should be your particular target of concern effort to bring him back, not to set him free, for excommunication.
Well, you could say excommunication is also the word for that, but this is good excommunication instead of bad excommunication. And this is continuing to deal with that person in the awareness that you're committed to their salvation, but they aren't.
And that you have a continuous responsibility for that person.
In my campus church, we sort of decided that the center of our life together was around the table, that is, the Eucharist. If you could share the body and blood of Christ together, you were a community, and therefore you were sharing this process of reconciliation. I guess when I think of that passage, you know, if you bring your gift to the altar and you remember that your brother has something against you, I don't think I have a question exactly. I've just been thinking about how much reconciliation happens at the altar, and then but this talking process is evidently more necessary than we have thought.
Well, there might be that if there are people who know each other pretty well, that you kind of have a tacit predisposition to reconcile, so that if you've been squabbling with somebody through the week and then your eyes meet across the table, You just know that the fact that you're taking the emblems together means that that's forgotten. It might be. But I think that would be the exception, that the normal thing would be talk about it first.
Because people share meals together, I mean families, and don't communicate, that and don't look each other in the eye, so that that's not implicit.
No, the free churches that have tried to structure this with some faithfulness actually have a preparatory process. Sometimes it's a prior meeting in which you actually go around the room and say, are you ready to celebrate the communion together? Other times it's a visitation by the leadership of the community asking, do you have anything against anybody? Also the Calvinist churches that reintroduced this following Martin Bucer have that kind of thing, that the to partake unworthily, not discerning the Lord's body, according to 1 Corinthians 11, is a bad thing to do. It isn't a good thing to receive the sacrament if you are not in fellowship. And discerning the Lord's body, for other people than Catholics and Lutherans, doesn't mean thinking that the bread is the flesh of Jesus. It means discerning the body of all of us around here as together. So the people in Corinth were being scolded for having an upper class and a lower class communion separated. Paul says that is not celebrating the body. And if you can't be reconciled, then this bread is bad for you. So that's why there is actually a process of asking, are we ready to do this together? And sometimes actually time is left in the service for people to walk and mill around and meet each other and before you go on with the service.
Is there a place for confession of sins between you and God, or does it have to involve a third party?
I wouldn't say legalistically that it has to involve a third party, especially if the kind of offense is something whose victim isn't identifiable. Or, I don't know, it's leaving a coffee cup in the woods a victimless offense? Certainly, I wouldn't want to set aside the possibility that an acceptance of forgiveness and a confession of sinfulness can be simply in prayer between the person and God, to the extent to which the offense has no social form. But if someone is offended, or there is a victim, or if I know I'm guilty so much that I can't forgive myself, but I can forgive God about it, then the access to others is still important. Well, our time is up. Thank you much. Mm-hmm.